Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Respectfully Disagree. So this has been a conversation years in the making. Our loved ones and acquaintances have all started to sound like therapists themselves. They're either pawning their diagnoses off on us or they're dispensing therapy without ever having been to therapy or knowing how to dispense therapy, so to speak. So today we thought that we'd talk about this advent of therapy speak in our everyday lives, what it means, and what impact they've had on our relationships, whether that's good or bad. And to do this, we have a very special guest with us. We have a therapist and mental health researcher who runs her own therapy practice called The Mirror Room. We have Farah Manekshaw here with us. So to start off with, let's ask everyone, do you find therapy speak annoying / harmful, or do you feel like it's normalizing mental health conversations for those who find it difficult? This is Shrishti, your host, by the way. Farah, I think we'll start off by asking you to weigh in.
Sure. So I think yes and no both, because I do agree that more awareness is helpful, but at the same time, a lot of these words have kind of started to lose their meaning almost. So if you're talking about awareness, you have to also think a little bit about the accuracy or where we're even using these words, right? So things like codependence, trauma, triggered, even the word gaslighting has almost lost its meaning entirely because of how casually we use it. Or even a narcissist is basically someone who we don't like. So I think there's that. Is it really normalizing these words, or is it or normalizing mental health, or is it just becoming, these words are almost becoming misnomers? But at the same time, I also know that because of mental health speak, a lot of identities are being reclaimed. A lot of the mental health discourse is also tied in with the neurodivergence movement, right? Or some mental health discourse that rarely gets talked about is the anti-psychiatry movement also, which thrives online, or Mad Pride. And that's also about claiming all these identities. And those conversations are also happening in smaller portions on the internet. So it's important to look at how those may be helpful, and how that's political and important. But at the same time, there is this diluting of other words. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, this is Rohita. And I agree with that. Also, like, fully being honest about the fact that I am very much guilty of engaging in therapy speak myself. Like, I've caught myself on many occasions lately where, and I've also been like explicitly called out by my closest friends and like loved ones, and just being like, why are you speaking like this? Because it's like they'll come to me with a problem and then I start saying things like, what was the trigger? And then it's like, what do I know about triggers, right? Like, so I've been guilty of it myself. So being fully upfront about that, I also do find it incredibly worrying also and annoying when I see it on Twitter and like people using it in like Twitter beefs and just like also like critique. It's just like everywhere. It's even like it's gone outside the realm of even interpersonal relationships, and it's kind of this like become a part of like general like popular discourse in general, and that's like really worrying to me. So yeah, that's where I stand. I don't know about you, Shrishti.
Rohita, I'm going to respectfully disagree and say that I think that some of that vocabulary and some of that awareness, where I've seen my friends who themselves have clearly gone to therapy and spent some time there, I feel like when they respond to my problems, they do it in a more like holistic way and in a way that is not, and they're also more aware of like, when does somebody want you to listen? When does somebody want advice? When is, you know, some of those basic sort of things, which I think it actually makes you a better friend in a lot of situations. I also want to ask on that note that what do we mean by therapy speak? Because I agree with both of you that where terms are being misused, where it feels like terms have lost their meaning, I agree with that. But where I feel like people are incorporating ideas from therapy into how they talk to people in their daily relationships, I think that's actually healthy, according to me. So also just throwing it out to the two of you, what do you even mean by the term therapy speak?
I think the popular culture usage of it is a lot of these words. I think it's also this kind of templatized kind of communication as well, where people are. It almost sounds a little bit, and it sometimes can come off a little bit formal. And I think that's where it gets a lot of flack, because it feels like a templatized, robotic, very corporate speak almost. So I think that's what I've heard it being used as.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much the same. Like, it's also interchangeably used with the HRification of language also. So, like, there's this weird interplay between therapy speak and HR speak in a way, because both are kind of, like, distanced and, paradoxically, it comes off sounding more cold, even though the intention is the opposite. So, for example, there was that viral tweet by this person, Melissa A. Fabello, who was talking about like how to set boundaries with a friend, and it was basically like the template that she had tweeted about was I'm at capacity and I can't basically be there for you. Is there a later date at which we can connect? And this is like, she suggested this as a template to respond to a friend. So it seemed like an HR response when you're like applying for a leave or something. So it's interesting, this tension between HR speak and therapy speak. So I was wondering, like, why, like, where do you think that comes from, like that overlap?
I think a lot of it is also because we don't really know how to have these kind of conversations. We're not really taught from a young age about how to set boundaries, right? And so a lot of that comes off as seeming very scripted, when in actuality, when you're using those tools reflectively or after maybe thinking more about them, it's actually a way of connecting or coming closer to a person, right? Because even if you're setting a boundary, it's about taking care of yourself and how can I actually be so present for this person, right? It's a way of honoring your needs and another person's needs. But sometimes I think because of the way this conversation's happening online, it can get a little bit distancing and it can come off as cold I think the intention of boundaries is to connect.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, listeners who've been with us from the start will remember that one of our first episodes was inspired by this conversation about the I'm at capacity tweet, where we spoke about the idea of boundaries and friendships and, you know, why they make us uncomfortable and where does this come from? I'm just wondering, like, how do you sort of draw that line between where does it feel impersonal versus where does it feel well-intentioned? And also, I think sometimes these also, the reason why they feel distant is that they become almost like a mask to not have unpleasant conversations or to not voice unpleasant feelings or to not voice what you're actually thinking. And you have easy tools to make it seem like you're listening or tuning in now or like you're doing this respectfully when necessarily intentions might not be that. So I'm just wondering, how do you differentiate between where it is a well-intentioned technique versus where it's being used to where it's being used like not genuinely but as a way to sort of get out of something in an easy templatized sort of a format? Mm-hmm. Just wondering.
I think one difference would be, I think, how much you reflect on what's coming up for you, right? Is this just like a slight kind of discomfort, and is it maybe just about prioritizing your own needs, and is it being done always, or is it done from like a space of genuine overwhelm, right, that I really can't be there for you right now? And I think it also depends so much on context, right? Is the boundary being set by, say, a young woman who's asserting her right to not get married, right, with her family, versus is it, you know, being used in a friendship to avoid a slight inconvenience? I feel like those contexts are so different, and I feel like the conversation isn't really capturing a lot of those differences as well. I think a lot of what would make a difference would also be the amount of vulnerability you have in some of these conversations. I think, for example, I think when we're using even the word triggered, I feel like it just becomes a way to almost distance yourself from your emotions as compared to connecting with them. Like, of course, triggered is helpful because I feel like people are understanding more about trauma responses. But at the same time, are you really exploring when you're saying triggered, what does that mean? What feelings are coming up from you? And are you also reflecting on why you are triggered? Like it's when we're triggered, it's not always just the other person who is doing that to you. It's also because you have a history of something. So I feel like that reflexivity somewhere becomes missing, and then it becomes more distancing than about connecting.
I also wonder, as you were speaking, how ethical is it to even speak, like, use these words? Like, we spoke in the beginning about how these, like, there are certain words that have lost their meaning, like gaslight, codependent, toxic, all of those words. Is it even ethical to, like, use them in a very cavalier way in an everyday conversation where they lose their meaning, and even they can tend to be perceived as diagnostic when someone else is, like, calling your relationship codependent without knowing what codependent actually means? Or if you're telling a friend about your partner and then they say that, oh, that person's gaslighting you, when that may not actually be true.
I think especially because psychology is considered, this is debatable, but psychology is considered a science, right? And it's an offshoot of psychiatry. And so there's so much power in that biomedical approach, and how historically it has been used to control, police, pathologize a lot of marginalized communities. So these words do carry a lot of weight, and I agree that it would be great if we could be more mindful before using these words. But at the same time, I'm also thinking about how sometimes we also gatekeep a lot of this language. As psychologists, I feel like therapy or mental health is seen as this mystical, complex thing, and I think that in some ways, it's helpful that it's been made more accessible. Like, for example, someone reading about emotional abuse and understanding their situation and being able to work through what's happening in that relationship versus offhandedly saying that's gaslighting without being careful about it. There's that difference.
I want to bring in the like controversial aspect of where the critique of therapy speak comes from, right? Which is that it is selfish, and it is a way to avoid accountability and to make everything center around yourself. I think one of the first characters in pop culture who sort of embodied this ethos and language, if you will, was Hannah from Girls, from the show Girls, you know, where she would reference a lot about needing time for herself and needing to just stay with her thoughts for a little bit, and like, you know, articulating things in like what we now recognize more widely as therapy speak. So that brings up the important question of, is it a way to center yourself and your needs and find a vocabulary to manipulate in a way that it all becomes justified in, you know, under the guise of self-care or putting yourself first?
When we're looking at some of the posts about this or some of the conversation around this, it's almost like, if it's inconvenient for me to go out, I have the right to cancel last minute because I'm setting a boundary. And then if you push back against that, you're crossing someone's boundaries. So that immediately makes the other person a bad person. Or if someone isn't serving me, then I can cut them out of my life. Or if someone triggers me, then they've done something terrible. So in that way, it really can be quite self-serving. And in some ways, therapy also does kind of, It can also be very hyper-independent in some ways, right? Like, I feel like a lot of conventional therapy is about being hyper-independent. It's about knowing how to fix yourself, and just a lot of these self words, right? Self-esteem, self-confidence, assertiveness training, and they're so masculine. And so I see why an offshoot of therapy has also become this in some ways, right? It's not just it's being misused. It's also a little bit of accountability that therapy itself as a practice needs to be taking. But yeah, at the same time, I do feel like it can be great in some ways for some people to reclaim themselves, in the sense that if you've had a lifetime of being I don't like this word, but if you've had a lifetime of kind of putting your needs ahead of other people's, and if you read something and that resonates with you, and you find ways to hold space for yourself, I feel like that's also something that's helpful, right? But that's coming from a different space than someone who's against mildly inconveniencing themselves. So yeah, it's all very complicated.
That's so interesting because I think we spoke about this some time ago also, like how whether like therapy itself is kind of individualistic in that sense because it prioritizes your well-being. And like a lot of people seem to think that therapy gives you agency to do whatever you want, as in like that's the place you kind of want to be. Like this is for people, of course, like before you go to therapy, that's the impression that you get. Like, I want to go to therapy because I want to be like free. I want to feel like better about everything. When like the outcome is not necessarily like feeling better per se, right? It's like being equipped with the tools to help process whatever's going on. I mean, I may have completely butchered it, but then the point is, like, the point is that it feels very there's a very individualistic bent to therapy and the discourse around therapy in general, where the priority is my mental health and not your mental health and our mental health, like our collective mental health. So it's like, I feel like that also like raises a very interesting question, which you brought up, which is like, while reclaiming my own needs, how do we like, it almost seems like the way it's set up is kind of like a zero-sum game where it's like, if I uphold my needs and if I do whatever I need to do to prioritize myself, then it's at the expense of somebody else or something else, and then that's okay. So like, what situation does it not become okay? Like, have we lost sight of like just like the collective good in that sense?
We valorize these traits, right, of assertiveness or of setting boundaries, but then who would find it easier to set a boundary, or whose boundaries would be respected more? That's also a question to take into consideration in terms of identity locations as well. And that's really important to think about. Or things like how, if you look at like the disability justice movement, right, where community care, mutual aid is something that's so important. Or just like alternatives to individualistic care would also need to be thought of. I feel like, so often when I work with marginalized communities, say if someone's queer, neurodivergent, disabled, you can't just do the work yourself. It's not you, because it's such a systemic issue, it's so important to connect your clients to communities where they feel understood and can experience that solidarity that me as an individual therapist won't be able to provide. So there is that element that's often missing in mainstream therapy discourse. Yeah. But I think we've sidetracked a little.
Yep. Respectfully sidetracking to exploring, you know, related ideas of like, you know, I because I do think that it's kind of important to talk about where does this, you know, centering the individual so much, like you said, in therapy speak and in relationships even come from, right? But that leads us to another important question, which is that does the advent of therapy speak point to a greater sort of devaluation of mental health itself? Is that how you look at it? Because of course, this is where we're talking about like individuals using it to, let's say, respond to friends or in relationships or in how they navigate their day-to-day lives, right? But what about where brands use it, right? And most famously, I think by now everybody is aware of self-care being touted to sell you like everything from like hand cream to facials to, I mean, you name it, and it's been sold to you in the name of caring for yourself.
Of course, it's been co-opted for very capitalist purposes as well. And it's so ironic that so much of self-care is about buying things, right? When it, again, can be a coping mechanism to, again, distance yourself from your feelings. So is buying things actually helping you connect with yourself and take care of yourself? Or is it something that's, a way of coping without really solving or without actually sitting with what's coming up for you. But yeah, I guess it sells well. And not to necessarily hate on it. I love a scented candle myself. But but also to look at it as if that's the only thing we're looking at as self-care.
So there's this book called Conflict is Not Abuse by Sarah Schulman, which was really popular a while ago, which I feel is really resonant right now because it talks about the problems with like overstating harm and blame for something that happened to you.
Yeah.
Just like something that's harmful and not good and uncomfortable is exaggerated and called abuse or something much worse than it is. And there is that tendency. I don't know if you see there being a trend here, like a worrying sort of situation where that sort of overstating harm has also crept into movements which are meant to like hold people accountable. It's like movements of like social justice also, if you feel like it's crept into that space as well. So that's a conversation that becomes important about like the way we speak about like the language we use. Like, I mean, overstating harm is like a, it's a therapy speak thing.
In some ways, like the whole idea about overstating harm, it actually might be harmful to survivors as well. So there is the risk of that happening as well. And that's concerning. And yeah, I agree that it does creep into movements. And I feel like in some ways it also ties in with, oh God, I'm going to use another very buzzword, but even in terms of cancel culture, in terms of how that also, any kind of hurt is immediately grounds to cancel a person, which again needs so much nuance. I feel like it's become converged with Me Too and cancel culture are now almost the same thing, when I feel like they're two very different ideas. Yeah. So I do think it's crept into movements in some ways. And yeah, and I feel like some of these words, like I said, should be ideally about connecting more deeply, or should be about, even if we're hurt, should be about getting accountability from the other person in a way that involves connecting with them, but it's being used in a way to just cut people off, which, yeah, can be pretty harmful.
That raises this interesting point, right? Like you mentioned earlier, gatekeeping, like how that tends to be, like we should be cautious of not gatekeeping language. And then there's also, like, I wonder what you think of this idea of the tension between gatekeeping on the one hand, and also like if we dilute these words, they're not available anymore for those who need it. How do we define who needs the words? As in, like, is that itself, like, is that framing also like kind of gatekeeping in a sense? Because I definitely skew on the side of thinking that yes, we should gatekeep a little bit. Like, it's a hot take.
The issue there is that we pretty much, I mean, as a collective and as an institution, we're actively pretty responsible for perpetuating a lot of harm. So that's also complicated, right? Like, I mean, a lot of these, like, for example, narcissistic personality disorder, and there's a whole cluster of personality disorders, and historically psychologists and psychiatrists have been guilty of diagnosing queer women with them a lot more than other people. So yeah, I don't know if I'm in favor, I don't know if the gatekeeping is really going to solve the harm. It's, I think the problem, and I feel like it's coming to me now, isn't so much the usage of the word, but it's the fact that psychology is being held as a science, something that's very hardcore, something that's very black or white, when it's not. It's pretty fluid, it's pretty complex, and you're pretty likely to be biased in terms of determining some of these things. I feel like, I think we use these terms as though it's very concrete, but I think these things are more complicated and more nuanced than just determining yes, this and no, that. Yeah, I guess the empiricism of it is what's standing out to me more than anything.
Another added layer to that is that sometimes I wonder whether a big problem with therapy speak is that it delegitimizes other ways of expressing yourself other than the vocabulary that we have in English and the terms that we use. Like, I remember a friend and I were talking about how, you know, our grandmothers had a common lexicon for anxiety where they used to say dil kacha pad raha hai, and that literally means that, I don't know how to literally translate that from Hindi to English, but literally it means my heart is feeling like you're feeling constricted, right? It literally means that I'm not feeling okay, I'm feeling anxious. It's a way of saying that, but it's a completely different vocabulary for that. I think one of the things that I feel also about therapy speak is that it makes it difficult to recognize that there are other ways of expressing, there are other ways of processing, which are not necessarily inferior in any way, you know, or it doesn't mean that that person hasn't been able to process or express well. But I think the rise of therapy speak also leads to this kind of almost like superiority to be able to articulate yourself in certain ways and be evolved in only one way.
Yeah, it almost feels like a trend. And in some ways, I think when you're saying about other ways of expressing yourself, it is pretty ableist to think about like verbal verbal communication and correctly identifying feelings as something that everyone should be able to do. That's also a really important point, I think. And yeah, I don't think I'd considered that before. So thanks for bringing it up.
And one more thing to talk about here is like, so the social mediaification of therapy, right? Like there's a lot of Instagram accounts and just like social media pages where therapy is explained in a way where it's like almost like in bullet points. So it's like even like how to deal with dash situation is explained away in bullet points, and then it's like also prescriptive in a sense. So it feels like decontextualized completely, right? And the account will be claiming to be a therapeutic thing, like run by maybe someone who knows what they're talking about. But still, if you dispense it to an audience of hundreds and thousands of people without any like personalized care or context, then that tends to be like misleading in a sense, right? So I feel like even that seems to be a problem with like in the way that therapy speak has proliferated in general. Feels like also like the discourse of mental health becoming so bite-sized on social media, and there's no accountability for the people who are dispensing mental health in infographics on Instagram. So then it feels like is that
yeah.
It, on the one hand, it does make therapy accessible and mental health conversations more accessible, for sure. But on the other, it feels like prescriptive, and then you can see it and you may think that you may pathologize yourself, and then that could be harmful, right?
Another risk of that is also that, say, you are unable. So a lot of these accounts, is what I've noticed, is that they'll also have some kind of techniques or something that you should do to manage your anxiety, or something to do to get through a difficult conversation. And I think, especially with things like grounding techniques, they need to be so individualized. They need to be done with such care. Not everything may work for everyone. And so, there's never any kind of caveat that, hey, this may not work for you. So I'm also thinking about the kind of pressure it puts on an individual that they've tried this thing and still may not be working, right? So I also feel like there's that aspect of it, but at the same time I'm also thinking about how if someone finds something and it has helped them, and some of these things have helped my clients in the past before accessing therapy, there's also that to consider.
Yep, I think that definitely makes a lot of sense. And like the yes and no aspect of your answer at the start is really coming back to us in multiple ways as we pick on all the threads about, you know, therapy speak and its impact on our relationships. And I think this is a really interesting conversation, and it opened up a lot of interesting ideas around therapy speak and, you know, conversations about accessibility, expertise, and what it really means to draw boundaries versus creating distances, which can feel alienating. Thank you so much for joining us, Farah.
This podcast is brought to you by TS Studios, the production company that brings the Swaddle's creative point of view to original podcasts and films.